doing? We all right?
Yeah.
Good. Oh, yeah. Good. Good to hear it, Chugs. King David's been killed. Turn to page 299 in your good books. That will take you to 2 Samuel chapter 9. David at this point probably been king, reckon the ballpark of about 15 years. It's a pretty good guess, I reckon. And today's passage is what happens when he meets someone who, on paper at least, is a rival for his throne. How does David react to that? And to start with this, I want to look at how traditionally, you're right there, Chandrika. Sweet. Traditionally, how people, I want to look at first, apart from English history, a rival for a throne. So I'm going to show on the screen 2 paintings, obviously not from the time, that depict this act in English history. Do we all understand? The one who can tell me the most about it gets this massive chocolate bar. Woo! Right, have a go. Turned it off. Nice and loud, Julia. The prince is in the tower. Who here doesn't know the story of the prince is in the tower? Right, it's
He's in Bloody Tower.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Or AKA the White Tower, but yeah, the Bloody Tower in the Tower of London. 1483. The old king was dying, who was Edward IV. And the Edward IV had 2 sons. The eldest one, also called Edward, was 12 years old. He had a younger brother who was also called... It's called the princes in the tower, and it weren't. One of them was a king. I suppose they were princes and all. So young Edward V, only 12 years old, becomes king. He's got an even younger brother, I think was 9, who was Richard, Duke of York. And knowing he was dying, King Edward IV said to his brother, "My young son is too young to rule in his own right. He needs a Lord Protector who basically rule the kingdom for him until he's an adult and come of age." And does anyone know who that was called? It was Richard, Duke of Gloucester. And Richard, Duke of Gloucester, said, "I'll look after your boys all right," in good Cray Brothers fashion. So he takes them and, for their protection, locks them in the Tower of London, where they were seen for a couple of months playing around and having fun. For their protection, locked in. And after 6 months, they vanished. Yes, they vanished. And completely vanished. And so Richard, Duke of Gloucester, says, "We appear to have lost..." In fact, you should be like this, really. "We appear to have lost the princes. This country needs a king, so I will be known as King Richard the..." Come on, it's the humpback. Richard the Third, guys! It was a humpback. Becomes King Richard the Third. 200 years later, 1647. 2 workmen working on the wall of, as you said, John, the Bloody Tower, the White Tower, found a box which contains the bones of 2 small boys. Obviously, CSI didn't exist at the time, but they pretty much guessed that they were the bones of Edward and Richard, and they were buried as though they were the bones of Edward and Richard in Westminster Abbey. That's what happened when a rival for the throne realised he could take it. History doesn't know, well, absolutely 100% that Richard killed his nephews, or at least had them killed, to become King Richard III. And in truth, if you know your history, it didn't actually work out that well for Richard III in the long run. But that's certainly a situation of how someone dealt with a rival for the throne. And it happens in the Bible as well. If you want to look, not now, but another time, at what happens to the kings of Israel after the kingdom split, so David's family, so David, Solomon, Rehoboam, they remain kings of Judah. But the rival, a rival king basically takes over the northern half of the kingdom. Rehoboam throws Rehoboam out of the northern kingdom. So you have 10 countries, 10 tribes, the tribes of Israel, go off on their own. And it's a real mess for the next few hundred years as new kings turn up, kill the old king, kill their family. So in 1 Kings 15, King Baasha kills King Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, and the entire of Jeroboam's family when he becomes king, because he doesn't want any of them turning up to then kill him. 2 kings down the line, kill Zimri, kills all of King Baasha's family, King Baasha and all of his family. And then King Ahab. When King Ahab died and King Jehu turns up, he beheads 70 princes. 70 princes to make sure they don't become king. That's pretty shocking, isn't it? I think so. So when becoming king, they didn't want to leave a rival threat for the throne. Now, was there a remnant of King Saul's line of when David becomes king? Well, at first, if you remember, I mentioned 3 weeks ago when I spoke last, there was one. King Saul had one son left, and he became king of Israel for 2 years, Ish-bosheth. And in 2 Samuel chapter 4, which is a chapter completely about how Ish-bosheth is murdered, there's this one verse which introduces this other character. And it's a really weird verse, because it's a chapter which is completely just about the murder of Ish-bosheth, apart from this one verse, which in our Bibles is literally in brackets, literally in parentheses. And it's a tangent from the rest of the passage, but it just gives this indication that this person here is in the background, this chap called Mephibosheth. So it's 2 Samuel 4, chapter 4. Jonathan, son of Saul, had a son who was lame in both feet. He was 5 years old when news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. His nurse picked him up and fled, but as she hurried to leave, he fell and became disabled. His name was Mephibosheth. So, how did David treat this living remnant of Saul's line? I'm going to read the chapter. So, 2 Samuel chapter 9. Oh, Julia, forgot that. Yeah. Man of my word. Right. David asked, "Is there anyone still left in the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. They summoned him to appear before David, and the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" "At your service," he replied. The king asked, "Is there no one still alive from the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness?" Ziba answered the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He's lame in both feet." "Where is he?" the king asked. Ziba answered, "He's at the house of Machir, son of Amiel, in Lodabar." So King David had him brought from Lodabar, from the house of Machir, son of Amiel. When Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down low to pay him honor. David said, "Mephibosheth." "At your service," he replied. "Don't be afraid," David said to him, "for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the lands that belong to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table." Mephibosheth bowed low and said, "What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me?" Then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's steward, and said to him, "I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring in the crops, so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mephibosheth, grandson of your master, will always eat at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "Your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servant to do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table. He was lame in both feet. For David, any sons of Saul, really grandsons of Saul, were a possible threat to his throne. Yes, Mephibosheth was lame in both feet, but he had a son, Micah, another in Saul's line. On paper, Mephibosheth was a threat to David's throne. So, where can we find Mephibosheth? Now, David is, where's the pointer here? Jerusalem's there, just in the border of Benjamin's land. And King Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. So you'd have thought, as a grandson of someone from the tribe of Benjamin, that Mephibosheth would be here, near Benjamin, near the royal court. Lodabar is there. He had run away, or his lame in both feet, been carried away, as far as he possibly could get from David's court, yet remaining within the land of Israel. He'd run far away, a place called Gilead, on the eastern side of the River Jordan, in northeast Manasseh. And why was he living there? He had no family links there. Why? Because he probably thought that David was going to try and kill him. Either because he was a grandson of the perceived enemy, King Saul, to David, or that he was seen as a living threat to the throne. How did Mephibosheth have expected to have been treated? As a grandson of Saul, and as someone disabled, living in a time, I don't know when it's ever easy for some, a time where it's been easy for someone to be disabled. But certainly in the Middle East at that time would not have had an easy life. As with our last sermon, we mustn't judge the Bronze Age society that this was with our sort of 21st century eyes and 21st century morals. And the Bible does sometimes sort of throw us weird verses that we can't really relate to because, yeah, ultimately we're not of the time. You know, we're of a modern time. If you, I don't expect you to look at it now, but just in the previous chapter, we see two sides of David which, to us, seem contrasting. The first is that in consolidating his throne, David kills two-thirds of the male people of the land of Moab, which is shocking. And yet, in exactly the same chapter, we're told in verse 15 that David rules in a manner which is right and just. I'm only making this point because it's hard for us. We can't sort of prejudge how David would act and actually look at it with our sort of 21st century eyes, 21st century morals. Because, frankly, if David had killed Mephibosheth here and now, would we look at it as though he'd done a bad thing? Anyway. Furthermore, how does Mephibosheth see himself? He's one line here. What is your servant that he should notice a dead dog like me? As I said, it's never been easy for a disabled person. He certainly seems to have an extremely low opinion of himself, be it that he's a disabled adult or that he's the grandson of a perceived enemy. And yet this is it. How is Mephibosheth actually treated? He's treated as a prince. Saul's lands are restored to him, probably around Benjamin, around Gibeah, which is just north of Jerusalem. He's got servants restored to him. The family that were Saul's servants are restored to him. And Mephibosheth is treated as family. He says here, Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. He lives not in his newly restored lands in Gibeah. He lives in the palace. He's treated as an adopted son of David. He's restored to his birthright as a grandson of Saul, albeit not the throne. He's restored to the birthright of the lands and the finance from that. He could support himself. When David says this to him, I mean, he must have been absolutely terrified while he was being carried from Lodabar to Jerusalem. You see there where David says at the start, do not be afraid. I can imagine David was saying that because Mephibosheth was afraid. And then when David actually unpacks these generous gifts that he has given him, how long do you think it sort of took in Mephibosheth's brain to realise he's not going to be killed here, he's going to be blessed? And what an amazing turn from what he was expecting to the grace that he actually received. How long do we think it took for Mephibosheth to realise he was being serious? Because common sense wise, Mephibosheth was right to have been scared. Common form would have been, as we see from what happened to the other kings later on when they took over, for Mephibosheth to have been gotten out of the way, either as an act of revenge because people thought David didn't like Saul, or because he was a living threat to the throne. And yet David shows Mephibosheth an unexpected grace, absolutely unbelievable grace, crazy, outrageous grace, as we see here for Jonathan's sake. So what lessons can we take from this story of Mephibosheth as 21st century Christians? Had Mephibosheth been shown a lot of grace? Yes. As followers of Jesus Christ, we have been shown a vastly superior, so much greater grace than the one we read about here with Mephibosheth. Like other figures in the Old Testament, so Abraham, Joseph, Moses and others, King David displays characteristics, like characteristics which we would later see truly revealed in the Messiah, in Jesus Christ. As in David's relationship here with Mephibosheth, bringing someone wholly undeserving, wholly unworthy into his royal court, it's the same for us with God, that we too receive outrageous, unbelievable, unexpected grace. So here, Mephibosheth is actually quite a good metaphor for our relationship, for us as followers of Jesus Christ. So just as Mephibosheth was hiding far away in Lodabar, to then be collected, gathered up, and housed in a palace, treated like family, so too are followers of Jesus Christ. We were, metaphorically speaking, living far away from God, and yet we have been collected in and given amazing assurances, amazing promises. So what promises have we been given? Well, firstly, the New Testament tells us that we are called children of God. 1 John 3 verse 1, see what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are. That's astonishing. I know what wrong things I've done this week, and I'm not going to stand up here and tell you. You know what wrong things you've done this week as well. Don't expect you to stand up and share. We can be called children of God. Isn't that mind-blowing? Secondly, after being called children of God, we are heirs of God. Two passages here, one from Galatians, one from Romans. When the set time had fully come, God sent his Son, born of a woman born under law, to redeem those under the law, that we might receive adoption to sonship. Because you're his sons, God sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts. The Spirit who calls out, Abba Father, says Daddy. So you're no longer a slave, but God's child. And since you're his child, God has made you an heir. And then from Romans, the Holy Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are God's children. Now if we are children, then we are heirs. Heirs of God, co-heirs with Christ, if indeed we share with his sufferings in order that we may share in his glory. So, as followers of Jesus Christ, we've been called children of God, called heirs of God. Thirdly, we've been adopted by God. That is from Ephesians. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us in the heavenly realms with every spiritual blessing in Christ. For he chose us in him before the creation of the world to be holy and blameless in his sight. In love he predestined us for adoption to sonship through Jesus Christ, in accordance with his pleasure and will, to the praise of his glorious grace, in which he has freely given us in the one he loves. In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins in accordance with the riches of God's grace that he lavished on us. How unbelievably cool are these verses? They are amazing. Have we been followers of Jesus for so long? Have we heard verses like these so often, so regularly, maybe since childhood, that we are not stunned by the sheer, amazing, outrageous grace that God has shown us, that God has graced us with? Are we so used to reading verses like these that they don't actually make their way from the page? They don't work their way past our ears to actually make a real impact in our hearts and our minds. We were far away from God, but we've been shown absolutely outrageous grace. We've been brought into the court of a king. We've been treated like sons and daughters, as children of a king, when in truth, we deserve the opposite, as the rebels, sinners, failures, that we know that we are. Let's compare. How could God have treated us with how God has treated us? Do we realise, I know what wrong things I've done this week, but do I honestly know how low I am? God does. The truth is, I don't. And yet, do we realise how high we've been raised? No, we don't. For Mephibosheth, it was unexpected grace to have received. He wasn't expecting to get it. But for David, it was expected grace to have shown. Why? Because it was in David's character. We can ask, why on earth would the creator of the universe love us? Why on earth would he give a monkey's about 60 people sat in an old school building in the East End of London? Why? Because love is God's character. 1 John 4, second half of 1 John 4 verse 8. God is love. Love is God's character. Now to Mephibosheth. How would he have behaved at court? We know Mephibosheth was in court for quite a long while. He turns up in one last story later on, which I'm not going to read out now, but you're welcome to read at your pleasure later, in 2 Samuel chapters 16 and 19, which is during the Civil War, which happens after David messes up with Bathsheba. And there's a civil war with one of his sons, Absalom, who tries to wrest the throne from him. And Mephibosheth turns up. We know from that he's still in the court. It's a bit of a weird story. You're welcome to read it later. But we know, therefore, that he's remained in the court for at least a decade. And you would have thought, to an extent, keeping his head down. You would have thought he probably wouldn't have been walking around with a T-shirt that said, King Saul rocked. He would have surely kept his head down. Do we act like those who have been brought into a royal court? I don't know what your personal opinions on Sherry Blair are, but if you weren't expecting to go from Mephibosheth to Sherry Blair, were you? He's like, what? Yeah, Sherry Blair. This is the segue. I don't know what you think about Sherry Blair, but if the press is to be believed, the royal family didn't really like her. The Queen got upset because while she'd invited the Blairs to holiday with them at Balmoral, in her diary, which she then published, she wrote about her bedroom antics with Tony. I mean, frankly, I think that would upset any of us, but the Queen got a bit upset about that. Sophie Wessex described Sherry as horrid, horrid, and the Queen Mother, was mortified at Sherry's brazen behaviour because she wore trousers to dinner. Trousers! As followers of Jesus Christ, do we behave like people who have been brought into a royal court? We are children of God. We are heirs of God. We've been adopted by God. Do we act like the sons and daughters in the royal court that we are? If we're not, metaphorically speaking, hiding out in Lodabar as Mephibosheth was, but rather are in the royal court in Jerusalem, the spirit of the heavenly Jerusalem, at Mount Zion, we should behave as such. Some passages, verses here from Hebrews. You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful, and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. I want to finish by reading, and I've got some previous of doing this, reading a hymn which has been buzzing around my head since I started preparing this talk 3 weeks ago. Previously, when I had a hymn that had been buzzing around my head, I made you all stand up and sing it. Fear not, said he, for mighty dread had seized their troubled minds. I will not be doing that today. It's one of my classics from my childhood, but constantly, I mean, obviously I trust this, God been sort of bricking my brain with this. Every time I've been going through this, it's been buzzing through my head constantly, but I have been assured we do not know it here, and we will not be singing it. So I'll be reading it as poetry. It's a hymn by a chap called Robert Boswell, who lived 250 years ago. Behold what love, what boundless love, the Father hath bestowed on sinners lost, that we should be now called the sons of God. No longer far from him, but now, by precious blood made nigh, accepted in the well-beloved, near to God's heart we lie. What we in glory soon shall be, it does not yet appear, but when our precious Lord we see, we shall his image bear. With such a blessed hope in view, we would more holy be, more like our risen, glorious Lord, whose face we soon shall see. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. Cheers.